Welcome to this episode of the Public Circle podcast. My name is Adam Olson, the member of the Legislative Assembly for Saanich North and the Islands. In this episode of the Public Circle podcast, I connect with Dr. Ambrose Marsh. Ambrose has been in family medicine for a number of years now and practicing in Sydney. He's had a number of different leadership roles, including as the chief of staff at the Saanich Peninsula Hospital, and he's now working in the Health Authority, Island Health. We talk about the many aspects of the crisis in family practice here in British Columbia. It's been one of the biggest challenges since my election 2 years ago was addressing the issue of a lack of family doctors in my riding. It's not just in my riding. It's in many communities across British Columbia. So we talk about the crisis in family practice. We talk about how we use the system, how doctors and patients both use the medical system that we've got. We talk about transitions in life as we age and prepare for the next stage in life. What tools do we have at our disposal? And we also talk about healthy living, nutrition, diet, recreation, living an active life. So, I hope that you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Ambrose Marsh. Ambrose Aloysius Marsh.
The third. The third, my father and grandfather.
The third. You couldn't carry that brilliant name on your own. You'd have to, three generations have to carry the weight of that name.
But the question that always comes up is, like, what were my great-great-grandparents actually thinking when they pulled those out?
Ambrose Aloysius Marsh. And what were your great-grandparents thinking when they're like, yeah, that sounds good. Let's just keep this going. This is a good thing. So you're here today to, well, we're going to have a conversation, I think, about healthcare. And there's clearly, I think, the biggest issue that I've faced since getting elected 2 years ago, and it's 2 years ago yesterday, that the biggest social issue is a lack of primary care. So maybe you could talk about, as a primary care doctor, a primary care physician, how did you, let's start at the very beginning. How about who are you and how did you get into doing what you do?
We could take up 30 minutes doing that. So yeah. Ambrose Aloysius Marsh III, born in Chicago, brought up in Toronto, went to medical school in London, Ontario, had never been to BC, came out to do my internship at the Jubilee in 1979 and basically never left. I did locums for 8 years. So that's filling in for doctors. And I did that in Victoria, in Souk, on the peninsula eventually, not till 1985. I did some on Pender. And partially because the education of the day, there wasn't a lot of, if you didn't go into a specialty, you didn't have a lot of understanding of what actually family practice was. And I was young. I graduated when I was 25. So partly it was to understand what the job was, try to get a sense of where I might want to work. And doing locums, you work when you want to and you take some time off. And I did some traveling and I did some young adult things.
Cool. And yeah. So what got you excited about becoming a doctor, a family doctor?
So, okay. So,
or were you ever excited?
Well, so that story, I was in Ontario. So grade 13, I went to the guidance counselor saying, what do I want to be when I grow up? And she goes, well, what do you like? And I go, well, I'm good in math and I'm good in sciences and chemistry. And she goes, you can be a chemical engineer. So I was going to be a chemical engineer. So I went to university and took engineering math and took a bunch of different sciences and math. And somebody said, well, that's pre-med. And I'd honestly not thought about it. There's no doctors in my family. I tried to avoid doctors, especially when I was a kid. You used to get needles every time you went to the doctor. So, but my stepbrother was going into medicine. And I said, okay, what do you have to do to get into medicine? And they said, get good marks. And I go, I was a good student, but you know, the next level, and to be honest with you, anybody listening who has family or children or grandchildren trying to get into medical school now, the expectations are, from my perspective, unrealistic, that you can't be healthy and human and get into medical school because of the marks and expectations. And recently, just to diverge a bit, I went to a lecture, a medical group, Sunday brunch on burnout. And somebody quoted a number like 40% of medical students are burnt out when they graduate. And something like 50% of residents are burning out or have symptoms of burnout when they're finishing their residency. So, I mean, that's a concern in its own right, because to be honest with you, I had a great time in medical school. I got in, there was 107 people in the class. I was probably number 104. I'd like to think I wasn't right at the bottom. I've made friends for life. I have 6 or 7 friends that I've known for 44 years who are dear to my heart. I had fun and I came out here and carried on. So I was lucky. It was a different time. I came out of medical school with $8,000 worth of debt. My parents didn't pay any money. I had good summer jobs. I lived cooperatively. I didn't travel. We didn't need cars. We cycled to university. And that worked. It's a different world. So then the only other sidelight to that is the way I got through medical school was selling women's shoes, and I was a carny at the CNE. So I was good at hustling games and getting people to play. And going from medical school, going from working at the X in Toronto and then going to medical school was quite a transition. And it took a little while to tone down one energy and tone up the other.
I'm going to reconsider all the medical advice that you've given me now, knowing that that's what your background is. I mean, we've been kicking around the peninsula here for some time together. And as I said when we were in the opening here, this has been the single greatest or highest volume of concern from my constituents here on the Saanich Peninsula. I think maybe half of the residents on the Saanich Peninsula don't have access to a primary care physician. You drive by any of the clinics on any given day that they're open early in the morning. When I'm coming into work, there's a lineup down the road. And so we have a crisis in family practice. We have probably an iceberg situation where what we see is only a fraction of what we've got. Maybe talk a little bit from the perspective of a family doctor on the Saanich Peninsula, what that looks like to you.
So to carry on just a little bit, when I came out to Victoria, most of the family physicians were in practices of one or two doctors. There weren't large clinics. And those doctors worked in their clinics, worked in the hospital, saw their patients, delivered babies, sometimes did rounds at both the Jubilee and the General, because the General was downtown. And it wasn't until the General moved out the highway that doctors decided that they would either have their patients at one hospital or the other. So as we talk about the new doctors saying they don't want to work as hard as I do, I don't work as hard as the previous generation of family physicians and doctors did. The call was completely different. You'd be on 1 in 3, you'd be on 1 in 2. We've tried to make the job healthier for the practitioners. And this next generation have seen us work. And my son says, I don't want to be a doctor. I don't want to be doing paperwork at 11 o'clock at night. So we certainly see that. Another quick aside was from our engagement last weekend at Mary Winspear. Today, somebody came in and said, would you please be my doctor? I've got these health concerns. And I had to take him because his health concerns, he's a frail person with multiple issues, and I took him on. That doesn't mean I can take everybody on, and it doesn't mean the practicing physicians who are saying no right now are lazy. It's we're busy.
Yeah, I saw the result, and when you're talking about burnout, I got to see it firsthand just before Christmas. And I know that the Minister of Health, I've met with him a number of times. I know that he's trying to have better results and to solve these problems. And a couple of his announcements before Christmas, and the reaction to that by the family doctors here on the Saanich Peninsula, I then, as the emails were coming in, I thought, okay, the only way for me to do this is to just have a clinic. So I kind of flipped the script on you, and I said on you and your colleagues, and I said, I'm going to host you here in my office. I'm going to provide 2 times for you to come in and sit with me. And I just want to listen. And what I heard was exasperation, was a level of sadness, was a level of exhaustion that I didn't realize existed. And not only were the doctors speaking on their own behalf, but they were speaking on the behalf of their medical office assistants, on their colleagues, in all aspects of the healthcare system. So maybe talk about where the doctors are at right now and what the reaction to the government announcements has been.
So up until the crisis, and somebody has to give me an idea when that date was, but it's sometime in the last 10 years when we started recognizing that physicians weren't able to find family doctors to replace themselves in retirement. Because in my lifetime in Victoria, since 1979, there was a time we limited billing numbers for family doctors. We restricted doctors from coming here. Doctors who had practices could sell their practices for tens of thousands of dollars, and now they are worthless. So we've seen a massive transition. And to be honest with you, I never wrote the letter to the editor, and I never wrote the letter, but it was predictable because there were things that were changing that made us recognize that the next group of physicians were going to work at a different pace, which means let's just graduate more of them. If the workload, or if they want to do different things, emergency medicine, work in the hospital, do different things, deliver babies, but don't want to be working 4.5 days and be on call every other weekend, then we just needed more of them, and the medical schools were slow to respond to that. We now have these satellite campuses that are putting out new doctors. But if you think back to what I said, I took 8 years off. These new graduates are going to be taking some time to think about what they want to do. So I think that's one of the big issues. The other big issue, and it's so embarrassing, because there we are in front of the community saying some of this has to do with money, and we are making six-figure incomes. And so how can it have to do with money? From our perspective, there's two parts. One is this debt that some students are coming out, or some young adults are coming out with $200,000 or $250,000 worth of debt. So anybody who's, that math, arithmetic of that alone, plus housing, plus all that. But the other part is within the profession, there are so many other jobs that a physician can do as a family physician or as a specialist that pays so much more with so much less stress, headache, call, challenges, that the appeal to doing family practice is undermined. And a long time ago, again, maybe 15 or 18 years ago, the BCMA, now called the Doctors of BC, tried to put together a relative fee guide, trying to somehow pay relatively, again, I shouldn't make as much as a neurosurgeon, I understand that, but relatively to what we do. And it was, in the 23rd hour, it was scuttled. And to be honest, this is my sense, and I'm not a member, because I've always found the Doctors of BC more interested in our income than in some of our work models. It was scuttled by the specialists. And I think family physicians ever since have felt unrespected, undermined by even within our own profession. Then crises like hospitalists, where hospitals were finding they couldn't have doctors in the hospital to care for patients, and they offered lucrative incomes to family practice trained physicians. And many of these people are my friends. Many of them initially were doctors who had community practices who gave up their practice to work in the hospital because the money was that good. I am not commenting on their quality of care. They are unbelievably good physicians. But the model undermines community-based family physicians.
Okay, so there's two things that I want to touch base on there, because it is kind of ridiculous to think that this could be an issue that there just wasn't enough seats. Was that just the capacity of the universities at the time to be able to respond to the demand, a lack of foresight at the policymaking side of things to put resources where they needed to be in order to be able to respond?
I didn't sit at that table, I can't say, but universities are expensive, and maybe we graduated 107 for the last 20 years, 107 is good enough. And nobody sort of looked at the changing model. I took a year off 10 years ago with my wife and my kids. We went to Tanzania and did a project in palliative care that we're still engaged with.
That was 10 years ago?
It was 10 years ago this year. And then my boys and my wife and I cycled in Eastern Europe. Dr. Lloyd Hildebrand, a dear friend of mine, who in fact was my family physician for a while, wrote a paper then, well-researched within our community, about how the shortage and the crisis was coming. So we could see it, and I'm sure other communities could too. We're not any smarter than other communities. But at a policy level, I'm just not sure the ministry or the medical school saw it. And part of the challenges today is up until this crisis, the health authorities and the ministry really wasn't involved with primary care. They kept track of hospital and hospital beds and turnaround time and wait lists for surgery or CAT scans or MRIs. But what family physicians did was just the foundation, but they never understood it. And part of the reason they didn't understand is we all do it differently.
Right.
Each office of two or three or five doctors has a different model of care, a different model of communication. There was nothing standardized, where hospitals doing hip surgery, especially in 2019, you can get to more standardized. You can think about length of stay. You can do a lot of different things. Family practice and primary care is really quite a soup of different philosophies and different styles of care.
This is an issue of perhaps of remuneration, how family doctors currently, I mean, I think there's a lot of people that would just answer the question, well, I'll just put them all on salary. Well, okay, so there's going to be positives and benefits to that. A positive of that is you're going to know exactly how much money you make every year. And, you know, like the vast majority of us, well, actually, the nature of work is changing and we're all being remunerated differently, or many of us are. But on the flip side of that, what are the consequences of just doing that? Well, you know, are you seeing as many people or whatever?
What are the deliverables?
Yeah, what are the balances? Right. You know,
certainly I've seen, and again, this is not a knock on all contract physicians, but there's less pressure to put through if you're doing fee for service. So there are, right now in this province, and again, people may not know this, there are doctors seeing 50 patients a day. And sometimes it's because they're in rural settings. And sometimes it's because their style is working 8 hours, seeing six people an hour. You know, if I finish with 24 patients in a day, I'm dragging my butt. So what's the quality of the care being given by somebody seeing six people an hour, or the quality of care of somebody, you know, value for work if somebody's only seeing two people per hour? There's all different models. So there's the fee for service, there's the contract, or the contractual sort of model. And now they're talking about population based. You've got 1,000 patients, they're this age, they're this gender. Make some averages and put a package together. And in Ontario, and again, the Ontario model was impressive, but it had some weaknesses. And my impression, even before Premier Ford took over, there were some challenges in the funding. But their model was that paying a physician a chunk of money to look after that population, if your patient went to a walk-in clinic, you would get money subtracted from your income. If your patient went to emergency for a non-emergent visit, so it also tried to engage physicians and patients in a sort of longitudinal care using the system. I'm going to use the word properly, and that's people would challenge what does properly mean, but in a consistent way.
We're going to get to the properly in just a minute here, because I know this is another part of the spectrum that you want to talk about, or the whole continuum of care that you want to talk about is how we use the system. But I do have I hate to use the analogy of like a war zone, but you made the comment that neurosurgeons make more and so they should. And maybe I'll push back on that a little bit, because I'm wondering, neurosurgeons do a certain very important job. They deliver a very important service, and it's one in which you need an incredible amount of specialty. But I would also suggest that people working on the front line, such as yourself, also have a very important role in being able to diagnose and triage situations and deal with them prior to getting to the point where you need a neurosurgeon. And so is it really worthwhile for us to say that neurosurgeon over there is a far more important component to, or should be seen as, or maybe the people on the front line, maybe the people that are dealing with 24 patients or 50 patients a day, it's a fair argument to make, and not one that we should shy away from socially, to say that they should be remunerated for the incredible service that they're providing our communities.
Again, you can imagine that's a really awkward conversation if you get a bunch of physicians to honestly express those things. I think if people wanted to honestly try and sit down and go back to that relative fee guide to some degree, because again, don't forget, I did 4 years of medical, long time ago, I only did 2 years of undergraduate. I don't even have a different degree. I just have a medical degree. 4 years of medicine, 1 year internship. A neurosurgeon, 4 years of university, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency to become a neurosurgeon, probably another 2 years of a fellowship before they're even working. So there are different models just from an education point of view, separate from responsibility, but to not recognize the responsibility in the hub responsibility of a family practitioner. I recently had some surgery, and there was at the end when I was leaving, I sat with all the other patients, and there was a video talking to all the patients. And if you have pain when you get home, see your family doctor. if you get a fever or have redness around your incision, see your family doctor. If, you know, they listed a whole bunch of things, see your family doctor. That's that video. First, I was assuming that everybody had family doctors, and there were people having surgery who didn't have a family doctor. That alone shows you the system assumes we're there, and yet we're not there. So that's also very disconcerting.
So that's not a bad jumping off point to the next thing, and that is to the point about how we use the system and how we access the system. When you call the nurse line, for example, it doesn't matter what you call them about. It's going to end with, you should present yourself at the emergency room. And you know, it's a highly litigious society that we live in. So if they don't provide that advice, you might get into some trouble. But how we use the system, I know this is an issue that you raised when we hosted the round table back about a year ago, a year and a half ago. So maybe talk a little bit about what you mean by how we educate and how patients and people use the healthcare system.
So again, I was alive, but obviously not involved. When socialized medicine, for want of an expression, came in the 60s, you know, free medicine, what didn't come along with it was educating both the public and the practitioners about the responsibilities of making that work. And again, in the 60s, I was 13, I was having a lot of fun. I have no idea what the economy was like, but the cost of healthcare was probably reasonable. We didn't have the drugs, we didn't have the operations, we didn't have the artificial joints that all cost lots of money. And we haven't taught, and when I talk about using reasonably, both patients and physician, reasonable use, I believe there's enough money in the system to do more than, do almost all of what we want to do if we actually used it wisely. Maybe I'm off by some millions of dollars. I'm not an economist. But there's certainly a lot of excess that's being driven both by physician use and by patient's use or patient's expectations, that with reasonable education, it's your health, which is always emotional. It's not buying milk at Thrifty's. It's not, you know, where should I go on vacation? It's, I've got this lump. I've got this pain. I've got, you know, I understand that. I mean, after doing this for 40 years, the emotional part of medicine is important. But I had a patient the other day who didn't have a life-threatening problem, had a significant pain issue, and I did a reasonable exam, and I thought he should get a CAT scan. And right now, a CAT scan wait time is weeks to short months. And he went to emergency, presented himself, explained the pain, and got his CAT scan that day. And he was happy because he got his CAT scan. That wasn't a good use of the emergency doctor. It wasn't a good use of the CAT scan resource. It wasn't a good use of the system. And well, there's many, many examples, whether it's doctors ordering tests that aren't necessary because it's easier to give a person a requisition for a test than to explain to them why they don't need a test. It's easier to give a patient a prescription for antibiotics for a sore throat when most likely it's a virus, but you can see them and have them move on rather than spend the 10 minutes of educating them because they're coming for antibiotics. And to actually explain to them why they don't need it takes more time. And I'm trying to be not a curmudgeon here. We're all in this together, and it's a really emotional, organic issue. But I think we could all become more responsible for it, and I would say that there would be more money available for some of the challenges that we're still dealing with, whether it's volumes, whether it's surgery, whether it's residential care. But it was never part of the history of the implementation of socialized medicine.
Well, I see it in other areas. For example, there was just an announcement a couple of days ago about from the rental housing task force that I was on. And, you know, it's like, how do tenants and landlords, do they even know what their rights and responsibilities are? And when we went around the province, we found out that no, in fact, most landlords don't know what their rights and their responsibilities are or what the rights and responsibilities of their tenants are and vice versa. And so much of the relationship between the two can be mitigated, the difficult parts of the relationship, just by understanding what the other person's rights and responsibilities are. I see a really similar opportunity here.
Absolutely. I've never used that expression, and I think that's exactly it. We weren't ever taught the rights and responsibilities of having a socialized medical system. And on all parts, including government's role. I mean, again, it's a tripartite. It's the government funding And don't forget, and I also tell patients, don't forget, you're the ones paying for this. So if you want to have your hip done in a week, then there has to be a capacity to do that, and that's going to come out of your wallet. So understanding that, and again, I'm not a macroeconomic by any stretch, but how the government manages the money, how the physicians and the patients actually utilize that money is rights and responsibilities. I've never used that. That's a great way of thinking about it.
I just think it's such a disservice to classify our universal healthcare system as free.
Yeah.
And I think that has become part of the vernacular. It's become part of the narrative. It's free healthcare. You know, you look in the United States, looking up here to Canada and say, well, they've got, you know, they got a universal healthcare system and it's free. Yeah, you don't have to, and when I come visit you, I don't have to give you cash, but that doesn't mean that you're volunteering. Right,
and we already covered that. You didn't pay either.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And so, you know, when you take a look at the fact that 42 or whatever it was percent of the budget, $19 billion plus, has to be generated from somewhere. It comes from the people in British Columbia. It comes from some transfers from the feds as well. But it has to be paid for somehow, and it is paid for somehow. And I think as much as we could learn more about how to use the system, where to best access the system, when to ask, you know, when to access what parts of the system, and then as well take a look at the administration of, you know, I think that one of the things that we don't do a good enough job of, and this is me kind of becoming introspective about my side of this, the government side of it, is we don't stop to say, what's happening to the bureaucracies here? What's happening to the to how we are delivering healthcare? We just continue to grow and build on what's there. That becomes a pretty heavy, dense system after a while.
I agree. I mean, politically, unfortunately, medicine, even more than education, is a pendulum. The next party comes in and says, this is what we're going to do in healthcare. Because again, it's very emotional, it's very political. Yet, I've always been frustrated that politicians in running or leaders in setting platforms don't not only define what they want to deliver, but what the cost is and the implications of that cost. And being in the profession, we have seen times of plenty and times of cutbacks, which is a very hard thing to manage, while at the same time, people are expecting the same or more. So I've always been frustrated with that part of the responsibility of government and changing government and honesty in campaigning and honesty in budgeting. But it's not simple. I understand that. I'm not trying to oversimplify, but being in it for 40 years, I've seen those challenges and the changes.
Well, we do no service to anybody by simplifying anything here. I think what I've seen is that people really appreciate it when I complexify the situation and when we're just completely honest with the scenario that we have in front of us. And what we have, you know, we talk about moving to a universal health care system in the 60s, and now I take a look at all of the infrastructure that we built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and all of that infrastructure is now crumbling around us or needing maintenance, repair, update, upgrading. And now we're also trying to grow these systems because expectations have grown alongside it. You know, this is a completely different conversation, but there are very, very substantive challenges that governments face in being able to meet the expectations of the public while being able to deliver a quality service grounded in something that was started at a time in which, I mean, we were spending huge public money in establishing these socialized systems, yeah. And now we have to continue to deliver them, and it's a challenge for government.
Absolutely, must be.
So there are two other aspects of this that I'd like to cover before we move on here today. But one of moving on. Here's another nice transition. Transitions in life.
There you go.
Before we move on, we should cover this aspect of the business that you're in transitions in life and aging. And I know that you work in palliative, and your wife works in the palliative as leaders in this. So maybe where do you want to go with this part?
Well, I appreciate that you're bringing this up because this is close to my heart to some degree, or to a significant degree, because I'm going to be 65, so I'm not the 30-year-old physician anymore, and starting to recognize health and the changing in health that is inevitable. Okay. You know, fascinatingly, the amount of care or the amount of education we got in palliative care in medical school was minimal, yet every one of our patients at some point will die. They won't all get pneumonia. They won't all get congestive heart failure. They won't get hepatitis, but they will die. And yet that focus, and that's cultural. We don't like thinking about it. We don't like talking about it. And I'm not really wanting to focus on the dying part, but I'm talking about the transitions in frailty. Where we own a house, we've got a garden, we're driving to the store, and some of those things are starting to change. And the patients that I've had in my practice, and I can think of them by name, who recognize those changes and transitioned from house to condo, from condo to independent living, before a crisis hit, before they broke their hip, before they demented, before they got cancer, before... And we don't even know what before is, but there's always going to be a before something. And those people themselves did very, very well. Their families didn't have to deal with crisis, and the system didn't have to deal with crisis. And I'm not talking about the system just from a money point of view. We're not talking about money saving, although there's money to be saved in doing this well, but also the stress on caregivers, the stress on the public system, the stress on acute care hospitals, where the acute care hospital ends up being the transition for a frail person until a new plan can be developed. And I really appreciate the opportunity to, sorry about that, talk about it now, but it's a longer conversation, that right. We as a society have to think about that. Similarly, even... people who are living on the islands. I've got patients who live on the islands. The islands are a wonderful place to live and not always the best place to be unwell. Yeah. And we're trying to support the, you know, I'm the medical director for San Andreas Peninsula and the Gulf Islands. And when the leadership from Island Health went to the Gulf Islands 4 or 5 years ago, for the first time, the people on the island said, we'd never seen leadership from the health authority come to the islands and to appreciate the different islands, the different services they have, and to actually help them understand what we can deliver and what's much harder to deliver. Those transitions, those changes are long conversations, but I do think, and here's a scary one, the boomers are coming. And baby boomers up until now have gotten everything they wanted. You know, we've been a very privileged generation as a whole. There's certainly exceptions. How that's going to play out in healthcare and healthcare expectations and transition opportunities is going to be interesting. I've heard of co-op living. I've heard pod care, where people live in some sort of cooperative space or created space where caregivers can provide care for more than one family or one couple, and couples become individuals at some point. And looking at those things, there's a spectacular program in Nova Scotia, and a good friend of mine is actually working on developing it in Vancouver. We've talked about it here. It's called PATH, and it's called Palliative and Therapeutic Harmonization. And it's the idea of sitting down with our aging citizens, and it can be at any age, it doesn't have to be 92, and say, here's where you're at. Here's where you're physically at. Here's where you're cognitively at. Here's where you're functionally at. And here's what the future, as best, my crystal ball broke a while ago, but as best as we can sort of predict, here's where the challenges are going to be. And these two women geriatricians who put this together and have presented it, and I've seen it a couple of times presented, said not only do the patients, but the families really appreciate it. There's no question there's a small percentage of people who just don't want to think about it. We can't make everybody think the same way. I'm not suggesting that. But a significant group of people really appreciate it. But it takes time. You have to really get a sense of what's a person's functional ability and their cognitive ability and where things are at. And then you can lay things out and say, here's what might be down in the future, separate from lightning strikes and car accidents and all that. But, that concept of thinking about it in advance before crisis hits, it's a wonderful thing.
Let me add a wrinkle to this, though.
Please.
Because in Saanich North in the islands... On the southern Vancouver Island, in Sydney here, we have a situation where we've kind of got a rolling population. especially in Sydney. It's a nice flat area. It's great. It's a phenomenal place. This is like a commercial for people who want to retire somewhere. Sydney's the great place to do that. So when we have that situation, this must also add stress to the healthcare system in the sense that it's one thing for you as a doctor to kind of pick up my, you know, our family and my kids and you know, work through life with them. And we, but now we've got a bunch of people that are settling here and retiring here that come here with no doc. They don't have a doctor. So if you take a look at the population was an aging population on Saturday. 80% of the people in the room put their hand up when they were asked if there was if they had no doctor. I don't know that they looked into the situation in the healthcare crisis that we had on the peninsula when they moved here. Now they are given the stark reality that they don't. So they're disconnected at the primary care level. They're trying to find a whole other social network of people in the area to help provide support for them. And they're at a time in their life where they should be forward thinking about not just the new place that they're just moving into because they've just retired from out east somewhere, but also where they're going to go and who is going to help look after them in the fairly near future, not that far off.
And I agree. And the one of the wonderful things about that session, besides the attendance and the input, was that it was driven by the municipal leaders. Because again, the province has been hardly involved with primary care over the last 100 years until the last few years. Health authority hasn't, and to a greater or lesser extent, neither have the municipalities. You'd move into a place and say, where's the school? But you didn't necessarily move in and say, where's the doctor? Because you always assume there was a doctor there. But it does take a community. I mean, I know that expression has been used, and I don't think it's been overused. It takes a community to take care of a community. And I think having municipal leaders and community leaders separate from just doctors, I think we can be unbelievably innovative. Because the other thing here, interestingly, is we have this population of seniors, but to a significant extent, they're healthy, bright, engaged people. Because they, you know, 95-year-olds, 97-year-olds who are still involved in their life. You know, one patient came in to see me and says, you should go see so-and-so. She didn't come to Bridge yesterday, and so-and-so was 102, you know.
Didn't drive to Bridge.
That's right. She missed her Bridge game. So I think, you know, that's a big part of it as well, is trying to figure out, right. We can't expect the government to do it all. And the other interesting thing, as you described, people moving here from Saskatchewan or Ontario, leaving their children behind, where, again, if you age in place, and your family, again, it's a new world compared to 50 years ago where everybody sort of hung out together. It's, you know, and families spread all over the place, and trying to manage crises is, you know, for doctors and nurses and social workers, it's very, very challenging.
So this has opened the door for the final area that I want to cover before we shut down and perhaps get back again to at some other point in the future, but around healthy living and my jumping off point to get to this is that social network, that because that is a huge part of connectivity and social connectivity is a really important part to being healthy. But also, you know, there's the aspects of mindfulness and being eating healthy and nutrition and diet.
I heard you were upset about the sweets at the community engagement there.
Why'd you have? Yes.
I only had two. Honest.
Well, you know, like, well, you remember when I first walked into your office? I was 210 pounds. Like, it is. So over the last 3 years, I think I've lost about 40 pounds. And
for those of you who aren't here, he looks great. He does look great.
Oh, man. Fantastic. No, I think that. The point, though, is that it's very, very hard work. It's exceptionally hard work. And the decisions to not look after the diet part of it, or to not be mindful of, you know, and to not take moments to pause or to stay connected, that's easy. It is really easy to eat
badly.
Garbage food. It's very easy, and it's all around us. It's everywhere. And so my point in that was that when we're sitting and talking about health, we have to be mindful about the fact that, you know, I remember a photographer when I was in back at Camosun, the photography teacher said, "Wow, garbage in, garbage out." And it's so applicable in so many other aspects of life, including diet and health and well-being. You know, and it's hard work to be involved in a recreation program. You have to actually peel yourself away from Netflix and go and do something. You actually have to do it. You can't just do recreation from your couch. So
you're feeding into me. So this is going to come around on two different levels. First of all, health and healthy living, whether it's mindfulness and diet and exercise. And the one quick tangent is there is evidence that physical activity, not running marathons, but regular physical activity. We've always known sort of that being fit is good for your heart. It's good for depression. It's good for Parkinson's disease. It's good for cognitive decline. I'm not an expert on this. I've heard this from a geriatrician. There may be more to this, but one thing that this geriatrician said that the only evidence-based interventions for cognitive decline that are been proven or generally proven, and again, cognitive decline is a basket of different things, is exercise and omega-3 vitamins, fish. So
I'm good in a lot of ways.
You're good. You know, but again, so certainly doing that exercise is good on many, many levels, plus mindfulness, plus just calming. So I'm going to tangent around. Part of the reason we had that meeting was talking about primary care. But the new primary care model, besides having physicians, is team-based care. And some of these new people, the team, pharmacists, social work, nurse in practice, some of their skill set is going to actually be healthy living counseling, how to talk to you about eating better, how to talk to you about either treating, you know, eating well for your diabetes or avoiding diabetes, you know, how to do good fitness. So fitness. I used to lecture people on how to measure their heart rate and how much you have to do. Somebody, there's many theories. 2.5 hours a week. If you do 2.5 hours on Saturday, or if you do 20 minutes a day for whatever, 6.5 days, however you do it, somebody said 2.5 hours a week of exercise is good. Is that nice base that you need to do? So looking at living healthy, and I think the boomers are better, and I think the next generation might even be better than that, but we certainly see exceptions to that, and fast food is certainly one of those problems. And fascinating, the new Canada Health the Canada Food Guide came out, and it wasn't just talking about portions and Brussels sprouts and you know, how much meat to eat, but it also talked about eating with friends, eating at the communal table, the Mediterranean diet, because now not only are you're eating well, and you're eating in a mindful way with friends. So there are lots of issues there, and you can get somebody smarter than me on some of these subjects to share that information, because I think that's really vital. And I think people are curious and want to know, and they just don't know where to hear it from. But so thanks for bringing that up.
Well, we're dealing with a crisis in primary care, which was set in the 1960s. It was set decades ago. We're still dealing with that system. We're dealing with a system that people don't necessarily know how to use, because we haven't, as government and, you know, as policymakers, haven't taught them how to use it properly, haven't even necessarily taught doctors how to operate, you know, primary care doctors, how to operate within that system. We haven't really had honest conversations with people about aging and how do we prepare for the next stage of our life. We spend a lot of time fearing those next stages. You know, when I turned 40, it was like, you know, oh my goodness, right? You know, and so we fear the next stage of our life, which inadvertently will keep us far away from it. And we spend, I don't know what the percentage is, but far less time than we should thinking about the wellness and recreation and diet side of life. So in every aspect, we've painted a picture that, you know, we need reform all the way around. So you've noted it, and I want to give a shout out to the Saanich Peninsula Hospital and Healthcare Foundation for what they've done as the former chief of staff of the hospital, of keeping the Saanich Peninsula Hospital a vibrant, up-to-date facility for the people on the Saanich Peninsula. That is I think the greatest community asset that we have on the peninsula is that hospital. I also want to the amazing people that have started Shoreline and Medical, which was leaned in very heavily by Sydney, the town of Sydney, and the Saanich Peninsula Hospital Foundation, and the conversations that started to get that going. So where do you see you just noted, that's the last thing we'll talk about, but you just noted that the change of primary care delivery, maybe explain that just a little bit better than the very brief touch point that you gave it there.
So thanks for that, because again, you really wrapped up. I didn't think we could hit these subjects so well in the period of time. So when I first came, doctors by themselves or in two doctors, and even when I first came to the peninsula, there was a clinic here in Sydney and there was a clinic in Brentwood. But all the physicians on the peninsula worked at Sanpan, and virtually every patient on the peninsula had a doctor. So with the changing models, we're also finding that we want to create models where that we're keeping healthy physicians, we're not burdening them with 7-day-a-week jobs. And so these clinics and the newer physicians are saying, we aren't taught how to manage a business, and running a practice is actually a business besides the medical side. And we weren't taught, and I wasn't taught, and I think for some people that's just more than they want to take on. They want to focus on care. They want to focus on the relationship that they're developing. So these clinics that are coming in, and where they're calling them primary care networks or primary care homes, I still hope in my heart of hearts that there will be a point person or two that you know well, who knows your dog's name or knows that your golf game sucks. But on the other hand, there's a team, and based with information through an electronic medical record, where they're not leafing through lots of paper to understand what's been done in the past and what needs to be done in the future, that these clinics will actually be able to provide longitudinal care, relationship care, and maybe even prolonged hours, because Draga Jovic and I shared a practice for 25 years. And one thing we did is we both had evening hours one day a week, Tuesdays and Thursdays, and patients loved that. If they worked, they didn't have to take time off of work to see their doctor. And if they had children, and they, after dinner, they could come with their kids. And those sorts of things were really important. And I think we're taking some of the important parts of those practices and putting them into a larger, and I don't think it's a machine. I think at least on the peninsula, because of the work of the people you just described, it's community-based, and it's compassionate, and it's looking at quality. It's not just how can we see more patients faster and be more efficient. It's actually how can we provide good care for a unique population in many ways, this aging geriatric population, but we've got young families as well. It's great. I've got about 30 kids in my practice now of people that I delivered who are now coming back with their own children. I think this is a great model, but we're still having to, it takes time. These doctors have to understand, and there's other communities doing the same thing. So finding out where you want to live is going to be as important as how you want to practice.
Well, I think that what's really important about this and was pointed out at the session was about relationship. And I think, my relationship with my doctor is an intensely personal one. We get to talking about things that I don't talk about with just anybody. And so the situation that we're in right now leaves the public very vulnerable. And I think that as a provincial politician, I want to acknowledge the fact that when you have a lack of access or you have a lack of access point to primary care, when you don't have a family doctor, you are in a vulnerable situation. It is compounded, I think, when there's a lack of choice about who your family doctor is. And so if I just have to take whoever the next person is because they're just the one that's taking the patients, that might not be a good fit. And I think about my wife and my daughter specifically, but me as well and my son. And I think, you know what? It would be nice if we were able to say, actually, this is somebody that I want to have that conversation with, not I am forced to have this conversation with that person because there's nobody else. That's really... And I think that that's a lot of the angst and the emotion that comes in here is that not only are we not getting the care, but we're forced into having a scenario where you're vulnerable. And so I think that, in all of the stories that I've heard, although people haven't come right out and said it, it is an underlying theme for sure. And one of the things that I'm really happy about in living in this community and seeing how this community is solving this problem, and it is slow, and there's a lot of fingers to be pointed at agencies and at governments and everything, but the Shoreline Medical Clinic on Bevan Avenue is, according to the signage out front, expanding. The Shoreline Medical Clinic in Brentwood has moved into a new location. It's expanding. My understanding is that there's other locations that are also being looked at to expand into. In many respects, the greatest joy of the job that I have as a facilitator and as a networker and bringing people together and having these conversations is that while we look and point fingers to the outside agencies and to the provincial government or that federal government way over there, most of the big problems are being solved with solutions that are local and people coming together. And so when people say, well, what's the best part of your job? The best part of your job, my job, is to have these meetings, is to have these conversations, to make these connections so that the community can solve its own problems. And I think, you know, it's not a perfect solution. It's being developed under duress, but what's coming out of it is the community is coming together around it. The municipalities are coming together around it. The province is being held accountable for their part of it. Doctors are being finally able to have a space to express their feelings on it. So I think that what is evolving here very slowly, and perhaps far too slowly for some people, is actually going to be a better outcome in the end, I think.
I do think that's true. I just to go on a tangent, I sometimes worry about communities that don't have the same strength and financial backing that we've had, because it does create have and have not communities, but we are fortunate to live here, and I agree. Those people who don't have doctors aren't getting longitudinal care, and they aren't getting longitudinal relationship. And just to add, I did mention this at the engagement, I'm going to join Shoreline this year, and in exchange for working for another couple of years, my practice will get absorbed into the functioning system, and all the patients have been coming to my office saying, when are you retiring? Will now not have to worry about being left an orphan. And I think that's another great model that Shoreline has done. Dr. Tambeline has done that. Dr. Byrne is moving there. So some established physicians are going there and making it a viable place, helping attract new young doctors. And when they retire, their patients will be taken care of by that home and will have a new physician in that place rather than being left orphans, because we know other doctors have been unsuccessful in doing that. And that's been very, very unfortunate. And you have to take my word for this. None of those doctors felt good walking away. They tried. The system was so challenging and they were done for different reasons. And they felt terrible that they weren't able to pass on their patients. And it's not a comfortable feeling to be coming to your retirement, which is hard enough to imagine, and then realizing that you're just not able to put that last piece of the puzzle together.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Public Circle Podcast. My name is Adam Olson, the member of the Legislative Assembly for Saanich North and the Islands. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Ambrose Marsh. Ambrose has been around the Saanich Peninsula for quite some time, practicing family medicine, and certainly has a lot of experience and knows a lot of people in and around the riding. The problem, the crisis in family practice is not just a problem in our riding. It's a problem right across the province and even in many centers around the country. Getting people family doctor is difficult. And there is a crisis in family practice. And that's precisely the reason why the province is looking at new models of delivering primary care. And it's not going to be easy to make the change. And just as we've done a poor job of educating people how to use the current system, it's going to require that we spend resources and time working with our constituents and working with the public to ensure that they know how to use any new system that we create. And so it's a good lesson that we learned from Dr. Marsh that we haven't done a great job in explaining to people how to use the system. In addition, I think that we've got to do a better job of promoting healthy lifestyles and well-being. and we talked a bit about it in the conversation. And I've been covering a lot of these aspects in my blog, the transitions in my health and well-being and through life. I've been talking about that, writing about that. And I think that one of the ways that we can decrease the pressure on the healthcare system is if we're all living more healthy lifestyles. And so finding ways to ensure that people understand various aspects of diet, recreation, mindfulness, all of these are very important aspects to a healthy lifestyle. So we can do a better job of that. And as well, as Dr. Marsh pointed out, you know, we need to do a better job of having a conversation earlier with people about the next stage that they're about to enter in their lives. These are often emotional and difficult conversations, but I think they're necessary conversations to ensure that we're properly planning. And as we have a highly mobile population, many people in our riding and many people in our communities don't live near their family members. And so many people are socially isolated from their families. They might have friends around them and a social network, a community around them, but they don't have the family network there to necessarily support them. And so it's important that we have the resources available to have the conversations with people about how they're transitioning in life. That was a very informing and wonderful conversation with Dr. Marsh, and I'm very thankful that he spent time out of his busy schedule to connect with me and sit down and record our conversation. If you want to get a hold of me, you can call my office in Sydney at 250-655-5600. We're located at number 215 at 2506 Beacon Avenue in Sydney. You can reach us by email at adam.olson.mla@leg.bc.ca. And just a little note, it's the best way to get a hold of us is through email. This allows us to keep track of the conversations and the advocacy that you're sending to us, and it gives us an easy way to respond to you and get information that we get from outside agencies and from the government to send that back to you. So just a note, the email is the best way to get a hold of us and to keep the conversation going, but you're certainly always welcome to give us a call and to drop in to the office. If you want to find us and find all of our contact information, you can on the Constituency Office website at saanichnorthandtheislands.com. I blog every day, and you can find my ongoing blog therapy, as I call it, at adamolsonmla.ca. I talk about everything from my transitions in life to life as a member of the Legislative Assembly. Been getting into some philosophy lately. It really is just what's on my mind. It gives me a good opportunity to work it out in a public space. It's a political journal of sorts, I guess. I encourage you to check it out. We'll be publishing future episodes of this podcast every Sunday. We've got some episodes already recorded, some interesting guests coming up in the future that I'm really looking forward to recording our conversations. I certainly encourage you to leave a comment, to subscribe, to share it with a friend, to promote the podcast. Really, the only way that people are going to find out about this is through word of mouth. So I ask that you help us in that endeavor and sharing this podcast with your friends and family and anybody who think might be interested. Also, rating the podcast, however you're hearing this, whichever platform you're listening to this podcast on, leaving us a rating is also a great way to expand the base of people that we're connecting with. So thanks again for listening, and until next time, hayekwa.